Good day, everybody, and welcome to The Gray Matters, where we come together to discuss more than just the hot topics and headlines of the day from a black man's perspective. We appreciate that we are not a monolith and that every subject deserves to be explored with nuance, giving a view from all sides of the culture. So we're here to hopefully bring that to you every week with a little bit of class, some fun. Our panel consists of three guys that are absolutely nothing alike. And if you haven't figured it out already, you will soon come to find out just how much we love each other in spite of our sometimes very big differences. I'm Billy Craig, joining you today from sunny Delaware. They say that you can choose your friends, but you cannot choose your family. I say that you can do both. And so today, as always, I'm joined by my brothers, none other than Tito in Nashville, and of course, Jermaine, who is joining us from Portland. And today we have a special guest. Our baby sister, Janet, decided to join us all the way from Washington, D.C., and that is Rachel. Rachel, if you're nasty, how you doing?
Hello. I'm good. To see how you guys doing? Can't complain.
Boy, he be tearing us up everywhere.
Hey. I'm just glad you didn't say LaToya. You know, that would have took offense.
You know what? And I started to. And I was like, you know what? We ain't even that cool yet. We ain't even that cool yet. Be calling people LaToya. Well, let's get it. Let's get
to
it.
All right. I was waiting for you to tell me when to start. Good. All right. So, today we're just gonna get straight to it. So Miss Rachel is bringing us an expertise in the world of social work, and this is a topic that we've never—I don't think we've ever even kind of broached this topic. So I'm excited for what this is about to happen. So we customarily start off with ladies first. Just give a round question for you, and then we'll dive in deeper after that. So, the topic that we're looking at within social work is kind of some of the flaws and just some of the opportunities that we have within this country. But, you know, she's in D.C. Specifically to your area that you're looking at. I guess the first question I would have is kind of what is going on with the social work scene, kind of where you're at?
Well, definitely it's all based on insurance issues, what is covered and what's not covered. I only work with people who have Medicaid, so those are typically lower income, and that tends to link up with substance abuse and severe mental health issues. We work with homeless population, disenfranchised veterans, things of that nature. But the biggest issue is insurance. I mean, it's just terrible what's covered and what's not, what's available. For example, you know, our therapy is 2 months behind. That's the waiting list for therapy. And that's of the three services that we provide. So it's really frustrating, for
sure. So to be clear, real quick, when you say Medicaid, two things. When you say Medicaid, you're saying that's just your particular segment that you work with, right?
Yes.
So there are other
In social work, I mean, it doesn't really matter what your insurance is, but mostly with the government agencies, we're not, like, again, I don't work for DC government. We're funded by DC government. Mm-hmm. So we choose to work with only people who have Medicaid, which is free insurance in DC.
And just quick follow up also, because I know the answer, but I want you to kind of explain this. When you say there's a 2 month like waiting list, basically there's a bottleneck there. That means if I show up, I am showing signs of needing attention for mental health. Mm-hmm. Then what you're saying is, in order for me to get a therapist, mm-hmm. I've actually got to wait 2 months before I can even be screened.
So you can be screened. You can have your intake and all those things done with us. We'll, you know, set you up with a psychiatrist and things of that nature. But once it gets down to your actual therapy appointment, I mean, that's almost considered to be a luxury. And so we have there are very few, right? crazy? There are very few therapists who are willing to be paid through Medicaid because the pay is so low and the work volume is so high. So that's really what's at the core of why. So we have difficulty keeping therapists. We have a big turnover for therapists. I mean, they'll be there for 6 months, they leave. And it's unfortunate because the consumers are building relationships with these people. They're building a trust. And to just be abruptly taken out of that and having to, I mean, that's a whole nother issue on top of having to wait initially. But like you're saying, if you come in and you're showing visible signs, you're in crisis, maybe you're connected to us because you had a whole episode and CPAP had to come out, things like that. We would just say, well, go to the emergency room, or, you know, so that's really our go-to for those things. It's unfortunate, and it puts us in a tough position, but there's nothing I can really do except go with the flow, you know, that's it. Or try to be a therapist myself, you know, to the best of my ability within the parameters of my job.
The question I would have, do you work just with children or do you work with veterans as well?
So we don't work with children at all. The only connection I would have to children is if one of my assigned consumers has children. Okay. And of course, I'm always willing to give parents resources for their children, but we don't see children for therapy or psychiatric appointments or anything like that. And so, we do work with veterans, but we don't have like any special programs for veterans, unfortunately, within the places that I work for.
Got you.
So you don't work within like the VA system at all?
No.
It's just if they happen to be veterans.
That's what I wanted to know. I was going to dig into that because I'm like currently fighting with them as we speak about my father.
Oh, man. I mean, it's crazy. Like, there's technically a lot of special services and programs for veterans. But again, accessing them, getting people to be active once they're in the programs is a whole nother thing, you know?
Yeah, the VA system has actually improved, believe it or not.
It has.
By leaps and bounds in the Biden administration the past few years. But that improvement is, instead of you waiting like 8 to 12 months
right.
to get stuff, you're waiting like 3 months.
Right. That's exactly what the improvement is. It's just a shorter waiting period. Yeah. And again, it depends on who you're dealing with and how motivated they are to do their job.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you brought up motivation. Because that's where I'm going to go. Because, well, I mean, because you see it like it here in Nashville on the news, and I'm sure it's no different anywhere else. Well, you'll see stories and news stories of people who houses were visited by, you know, Child Protective Service or what have been visited and had, you know, some kind of episode and things like that. But then they're just turned back to the streets and then something terrible happens. And then it's on file that, you know, there are steps taken to be able to maybe prevent this from like whatever happened.
Right.
And like, but what do you think, like, why is this, like, we get to go out, like, but like to actually do something about what's going on is like a whole different ball game. Like, I've seen, you know, Child Protective Services come out to a parent's house or mom's house or parent, whatever that is. But then at the end of the day, they just like go home and like maybe file a report. And that's about it. Like, that's where it stops.
Yeah. So my experience with CPS cases is a lot of times the CPS case is already in the midst of an investigation and part of them getting their children back or preventing the case from escalating, they're sent to us. So the parent has to is almost forced to come to us and get mental health services because of whatever's going on with the child. I have only dealt with one CPS worker that was consistent about following up. It's more so like all they have to do really in order to cover themselves is put in a note saying I tried to contact them. Like I had, you know, there's cases where if the person is not able to be tracked down, like if we can't get in contact with them, as long as we're putting in notes in the system that we tried, we're covered. So whatever happens to them, and you don't, there's not really a requirement to put that much effort. You know what I mean? So, and also a lot of the cases that get, you know, reported to CPS are vindictive and they're based on some little small thing that maybe somebody saw and they and they misinterpreted it, or, you know, the other parent is calling. So it's just it. So the CPS workers become pretty jaded, and, you know, they're used to dealing with a lot of BS. So that's just ends up being a lot of paperwork for them. So, you know, you talk about motivation, you know, they get the call and it's like, they'll call you and they already have like this exhaustive tone, like, okay, what is the, you know, you're talking to them and I might find some details to be alarming or serious. And I have a tone of voice that has like a sense of urgency, and they're just like, oh, okay.
Take a number.
Yeah, I'll look into that. Right. You know what I mean? And so, and my cousin actually works for child welfare in New Jersey. And she is one of them that just sees all levels. So she's seen, you know, incest, murder, things like that. And so these little cases that I think, oh my goodness, you know, the baby looks malnourished, or, you know, things like that. They're not eating well, or the house. They just look at it like, don't call up here trying to get me to do more paperwork. That's really how they respond. And so then it makes you feel like maybe I'm doing too much. And you start to question, you know, whether what calls you should make and what calls you shouldn't.
Yeah, there's a fine balance there.
It is, because you do think maybe this is just part of the person's cycle. And when they're depressed, they're less attentive and they can't keep the house up, but then they have that upswing and they're okay, or you just don't know where people are. So it makes it hard to know who to call for what, you know? And a lot of times, if you are calling too much, or what the perception of calling too much or reaching out for additional services too much, then they start to ignore your calls. Yeah. Like that was kind of, I guess, my rookie mistake. You know, I was calling for every little thing, and I, after a while, I'm like, Miss Lewis is not answering the phone anymore. That's peculiar, you know.
Right.
Miss Lewis done put me on mute, blocked everything else, because in her mind, I'm doing too much. You know, and that's to me, it's unfortunate, because it's like you can't just make that call based on what you know. I feel like there should be some type of requirement that you have to take every call and you have to listen to every case, because you just never know. You know.
You know what? Speaking of finding that balance, oh yeah. Well, I was getting ready to ask a question along those lines. I'm sorry, Paul.
No, go ahead.
No, what I was going to ask was this: speaking of walking that kind of fine line, one of the things that I have heard, and I have several people in my family who I know of, and other people I'm close to who work doing social services. My aunt was a social worker. She's retired now, but she was a social worker for many years in Ohio. And one of the things that maybe you can shed some light on, there are a lot of people who have a really negative kind of jaded view towards people who receive social services, because there is this thought that they're just gaming the system, or they're just trying to, because it allows them to not have to work. Maybe they can get food stamps. They get other things for their kids. Like, they don't have to, almost like it makes it easier for them. And then you have others who it's almost the exact opposite perception, where it's like they avoid being a part of the system. They avoid getting services because they don't want to be tracked. They want to stay under the radar. Mm-hmm. What is your experience with that, and how should people who maybe have a jaded or kind of poor view of people who are receiving social services, how should we approach that? How should we look at that? Give us.
That's a huge issue too. Is that judgment? First of all, we shouldn't be judging anybody. You know, that's first and foremost, because you just don't know. And two, the services are available, and if people are taking advantage of them for whatever the reason is, I can't know for sure. I go based on the motivation that the person has, and I don't want to use the word humility, but I guess the respect that they show me for what I'm trying to help them with. I have definitely dealt with people who have a clear sense of entitlement, and they get pushy and kind of rude, and they definitely feel like, you know.
Entitled.
Right, yeah. Entitled. Is that going to stop me from helping them? No, it's not going to stop me from helping them. But then it's also, what are you doing with it? If you are, like, I've also been payees for people. For their social security, some they may be, again, disenfranchised. They don't have family. They've been in foster care. So I'll actually be their payee, and I'm watching their spending habits. And it's like, you know, why are you broke around the same time every month? You know, and so you just have to go by. I always tell people, I'm going to help you as much as you're willing to help yourself. If you're calling me every time you got to fill out a piece of paper with the expectation that I'm going to do it for you, you know, my belief in you as what your motivation starts to go down a little bit. Right. Because, you know, what were you doing before you met me? You were figuring it out. You know, if you're asking me, calling me for something every time you need something, or you always have a story, I'm gonna start to think that maybe you're not really self-motivated. But again, none of those things are gonna stop me from helping, doing my job, certainly. But you do start to have your favorites and people that you feel are more, I don't wanna say deserving. You know, I actually wrote a paper about this school, you know, what, because there's a whole like philosophy behind who deserves these social services.
Yeah.
And it is hard to prioritize sometimes, you know.
It's treated almost like it's merit-based, not needs-based.
And that's the thing. It shouldn't be the social worker or the person that makes the determination. They shouldn't be making the decision based on what they think the person is doing or what they think the person's motivation is. I mean, you have some people that have generations of people who have been on public assistance. That's all they know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're coming at you like, I want my Section 8, I want this, I want that, and they're entitled to it if they're eligible for it. You know, I mean, I have some people that I believe don't want to work. And but at the same time, those people are not going to have the motivation to go through the jump through all the hoops that they make you jump through to get that free life. You know, so it's like, you know, if you're not willing to go, they've made it a lot harder to get SSI for mental disorders. It's not as easy as it used to be. They make you go through a lot of, you have to see a lot of doctors. You have to show and prove that you're getting help and it's ongoing, that you're getting medication, things like that. So the system itself is kind of tailored itself to the new conditions. And I guess the way that they feel there's a lot of fraud and things like that. So they definitely made it harder. And again, the people that really want it or claim they really need it, they're going to have to show that they want it. They're going to have to go down to the office physically and stand in line and be there all day and deal with that BS, be on the phone or fill out all these paperwork. I mean, first of all, you can't even qualify for any of those programs without a picture ID, a social security card, your birth certificate, and proof of income. So you will be shocked and surprised how many people do not have all four of those documents.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people I've never been able to get any further because they don't even have the motivation to get those documents.
Get mad at you for asking for it.
Get frustrated. Yes, my friend got this. And I'm like, I bet you your friend had all four of those documents because there's no way we can even start the process without those four documents. So they really have changed it in a way so that, okay, if you really need these things, how far are you willing to go to get it? Because you know, we know addicts who they are the most creative people in the world. When they want to get those drugs, they will find a way to get them. So my thing is, use that same motivation you use when you were smoking crack to go out there and get your ID. That's how I look at it. And I try not to cut cards with the consumers because I don't want them to think that I'm soft, silly, yellow, whatever you want to call it. And that they think they can get over and BS me, you do kind of have to get tough, you know, with certain people. But again, it's not going to stop me from doing my job. And I'm certainly not going to judge them. I'm just going to go off of how they act towards what they supposedly need. If you need it, then you should have no problem doing what you have to do to get it.
Rachel Sharp, like, okay. Sir, I know that you're doing
tough.
I just want your ID.
It's a perfect segue to kind of my question. It's kind of like a two, maybe three part question. All right.
Okay.
So you talk about how you're viewed,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you're a woman and your skin tone. And then that's part of it. And then you have mental health for yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have a whole husband, you have a whole family, mm-hmm. that you have to care for. How do you compartmentalize your own mental health as far as when do you get a break mentally, emotionally?
So very simple. Do not disturb. Like, my phone goes on DND promptly at 5 p.m. every day. I mean, I'm getting text messages even now because it's not technically 5 o'clock yet. Mm-hmm. But once that phone, and you know, weekends are all, I used to work weekends. I mean, I still technically do. I put myself on the on-call, like almost 2 years ago. They never called me until last week. So, you know.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, so I'll probably take myself off that list because Saturday was
right. Billy was on call the other night.
But yeah, so that's
the Lord called him.
Man, it'll be like it's time to clock in.
Yeah, you gotta cut it off. Gotta cut it off because you need downtime, especially because I'm working mostly from home. You know, so I don't. Mm-hmm. I have an office, but because I'm trying to watch the baby too, I'm usually out here in the living room. So she's walking around. I can't really be in that, you know, setting, and I can close the office door. Yeah. So and I can go in from one place to another. So I just turn the phone off at 5 p.m. And also, again, I don't overexert myself. I match people's efforts. Like if I say, hey, I need you to get this and that done by this time, or this application can't go through. If they don't do it, I'm not going to be stressing, running up behind them about that. Even though I know a week right before the day or the day of, they're going to be calling me. Oh, da, 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 da. And I'm like, you know, I stop doing that. I stop running up behind people and reminding them to do things for themselves. That's not technically my job. That was me.
That was in our last because episode. Because I care. Accountability.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, though. And this is kind of broad, I guess. But, and I really don't even know how you would even start this answer. But has it, because you've been doing this for, I think you said, 4 or 5 years? Something. You've been doing it for a little while.
Yeah.
You're not new.
Yeah.
And so the question is, what is the one thing or maybe a handful of things where it's like, I change, like not just the way that I approach my job change, but how you, and I mean, that's why I say it's kind of broad.
Mm-hmm.
What has changed about the way that you look at humanity?
Well,
from the time you got started.
Golly.
Wow. Well, first of all, I already had a pretty jaded view of human beings because I was working. No, listen, because I was.
That's why I took the job.
Right.
I was a bartender and a server since I was like 24.
Oh, okay.
So
you already knew your clients.
I already knew.
Right.
I'm joking.
Levels of
Mr. Tommy, is that you?
No. You know how picky people are about their food, how funny they're acting, how they act when they're paying for things and they feel like you owe them a service. So the entitlement thing I was already used to, the delusional aspect of people I was used to, and, you know, not taking responsibility for your actions because I was working with, you know, at 24, whatever. But by the time I stopped, I was 35. So I was working with people a lot younger than me for the most part by the time
It ain't like you just decided to do this when you were young. You lived a life.
I had a lot of experience with how terrible people can be. So I already went in knowing that I wasn't bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, but I did have a bleeding heart and I was pretty I had my emotions on my sleeve as far as listening to people's stories. But you know, you get jacked around. Like, I mean, I was I went above and beyond, you know, a lot of times when I first started this job, because I wanted to show people that I care. But what I come to realize is that at that socioeconomic level, a lot of people grew up on struggle. They didn't grow up on love. So when you're showing love, the perception is that you're weak, you're a mark, you're somebody to be taken advantage of. So I definitely had to pull back with my kindness and just more straightforward about this is what I'm able to do based on how much motivation you show me for yourself. And that's really where I left
it. Let me turn it around though, because part of the motivation for my question is not just the people that you serve in your job, but how has maybe, for example, seeing how people judge or how people treat the people that you serve, how has that changed the way that you look at humanity?
Oh, man, that's a great question. You know, staff meetings are interesting.
Right. Those are the people.
Yeah, listening to what these people and you know how they are. And I'm just like, I do, but how are they? You're the one making these big decisions. So if you're being this judgmental, I mean, I've had conversations with doctors who just assume that because a consumer wants a medication increase in their meds, that they're drug seeking.
They're getting high, right?
They're selling the pill. They're just so judgmental and just extremely... and some of the notes that I read, you know, the assumption they appear drunk, and it's just, you just can't say stuff like that. They're unwilling to change, and you just can't make generalizations. Right. Even if that's how you feel, that's one thing. So we definitely, there are trainings that are required, sensitivity training, intercultural trainings that we're supposed to take to, and also trainings to how to write the notes in a non-judgmental,
consumer language
approach. Yeah. You have to use different language. I mean, if you're dealing with someone who's combative and you feel that there's no hope for them, you can't write in the note where they're just resistant to treatment. You know, it's more complicated than that. But well, yeah,
I kind of ran into that with my children. Where my wife had to actually go down to school, and it was about my actual oldest child. And the teacher wrote down that he was aggressive. And my wife was like, don't take that out of his file.
Right. That is such a damning piece of language. I mean, honestly, it really is. And I also tell people, there's a particular question on one of our intake forms. It asked, have you ever harmed animals? And I always tell consumers, like, when you ask that question, they always get, especially Black people, you know, come on now. They're like, what? I don't hurt no animal. Da, da, da. So I always skip that question because I feel like that's such a judgmental question. Like, have you ever harmed animals? It's like, are you trying to find like some kind of sociopathic or psychopathic tendency? But you can't just base it on that when there's no other questions to support that. If that's what you're looking for, you need to be asking specific questions about that, not that just that one question, then skip over to substance abuse. Like I leave that question out because I feel that is giving off the wrong vibe. Like that word aggressive. You say aggressive, you don't know if that person was having a bad day that day. Yeah. If they're detoxing, I mean, there's so many reasons why a person would have, you know, what you may interpret as aggressive behavior. But to put that as a description for who they are, I don't like that word.
There's a lot of room between.
I look aggressive to a scary person.
Right.
Plus, there's a lot of room between stepping on spiders
when I'm hungry.
It was just about, he was mad about a kickball game at recess.
Right.
That's all it was.
But especially when they have this language around Black youth, it's a setup. Mm-hmm. It is definitely a setup because there's already this pre-programmed idea of what a Black male is going to be. And, you know, any little behavior that ties into that stereotype, they're so quick to jump on that. And especially this level of socioeconomic people, where they're at in this socioeconomic level. There's this assumption that they're just these out of control people that
everybody's violent and just
don't value life, that they have a propensity towards violence, that they're, you know, not as intelligent, you know, and things like that. And I have run into
even people who actually have me, they just deem that they just assume you don't.
Right.
I was gonna say too, there's a whole lot of room between I step on spiders and roaches and I you know, cockfight, or I actually have dog fights.
Right.
There's a lot of room you don't flush it out. But I have a real quick question, real quick, because I know Andre had some, but I want to ask this question real quick. Do you think that more men that the industry, we'll just say, that the industry would actually be better if more men were involved than women. Because I know that there's an overload of women in that field. The ones who are actually in the field.
Yeah. In the field, like what I do. Yeah, honestly, it's a pretty even amount.
When I was doing my research on it in college, it was a lot more women in that, and they would only get the men involved when it was like there's a violent dude somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, there's definitely more of a balance. Or
women of color, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah, I work with pretty much all people of color. I think I work with maybe two other white people. Like, I mean, and I guess half of me would be part of that, but I just don't.
Nah, you with us. Right. You with us.
Oh, God. No.
It depends on how you look at it, right? So, right.
I'm going to keep it 100. My oldest son, his mom is he with us.
Yeah.
That's how I get down.
Yeah.
I don't rock like you.
But the disparity you think is more racial than it is like gender based.
Yeah, yeah, definitely more racial. Cause I work mostly with black people serving the black community. Okay. Like I think I had two white consumers, maybe, and one Spanish. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the thing is, they know what these groups are. Like, I mean, the white people, it seems like maybe they have, like, they always have a family member or something that has the connection or something, some other resources that they go to instead of the Medicaid route. You know, they're covered by this auntie's insurance. You know, it's always something like that. Or they just don't seek the help because they feel maybe it's a black space and they're not really, because a lot of our locations are in the you know, the areas of DC that are mostly populated by black people. So it's just one of those things.
Dre?
Yeah. So
I'm waiting in the wings.
Hey, you know, I know when to shut up sometimes. So recently I went to see Sound of Freedom. And part of the premise was that there was a guy who was working for Homeland Security who was in charge of watching or in charge of the pedophile division, like catching predators and things like that. But he also had to be the person who was taking the notes. So he had to watch the footage and he had to do all of that. So part of what I was just wondering quickly was just as far as I know Paul talked about your mental space and things like that.
Yeah.
But when it comes to cases and like people and your coworkers and things like that, and the term burnout, like how do y'all, or do you avoid the burnout? Like, cause it would be something like me, like I'm an empath. So I would take a lot of things personal.
Right.
And put myself in other people's positions and shoes and things like that, where it wouldn't be more of a judgment. It, like, me being judgmental wouldn't happen. Like, it would be me trying to save the world.
And
how does that, like, kind of play into you can't save everybody?
I mean, you quickly learn that you can't save everybody. You know what I mean? First of all, half the people that you get assigned don't even return your phone calls, you know? So, yeah, I do have a lot of, I'm also an empath, and I have a lot of understanding for people, and I want to help everyone, but you learn very quickly that it's for the people that show up. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the people that are connected to us, it's voluntary. There's a small percentage that are court ordered and whatnot. And even half of those don't respond. So you end up working with this. I mean, I think technically there are 100 people on my caseload. I probably talk to 30 of them on a regular, you know, semi-regular basis throughout the month. So, you know, I still have to at least try to reach out to the other people, you know. So, and over time, those people will get dropped off my caseload. But, you know, as far as being burnt out, it really depends on how much effort you put in. and how much of your own energy you're willing to put into this job, because it can be very stressful, especially when you're not getting the support from your team, from you're not getting the responses from your resources. I mean, you can very easily stress yourself out just running in circles. You know, for me personally, I've just learned to put as much effort as I can, do my due diligence, and leave it at that. No more going above and beyond for me, just personally, just because I've 95% of the time been disappointed when I've done that, or I felt played, or I was played.
Right.
And that's kind of, it sounds kind of like what you were saying a little while ago. Like,
I mean,
you help people to help themselves.
Right. I bought food for people and then found out that they sold the food. So, you know, so I'm not willing to do that kind of stuff anymore. I just feel like, maybe the next person might actually need the food, and the food that I purchased will be eaten by them. But now I just give them the resources for free food and things like that. I don't go out of my pocket, not because I don't have it or because I don't want to, but because I have to stand my ground and show that I'm not someone that can be used, because people talk, you know.
Boundaries.
I have a lot of consumers that know each other, and you know, oh, I want Miss Rachel to be my caseworker. Oh, I bet you do. You know. So,
right.
Well, but real quick. But quick, like, because then when and just for clarification on, like, to the listeners, like, burnout can be a few different situations. One could be like you, where you know, a lot of people think burnout like I'm about to quit this job, but
there's also
a level of burnout where you just take the check, like, you don't do anything
and check out. Check in and check out.
That is the people I work with and for sure. The higher, I mean, they just gotten to a level where it's like they do the absolute bare minimum. And that's it. But they don't plan on leaving the job. And that's the part that I guess I understand it to a certain degree. If you don't have any qualifications and you've been at this job for so long, where do you go? You don't quit, you know. But my thing is, how miserable are you? How miserable are you to the point where it's motivating you to leave that industry? Because for me, I was miserable working as a bartender. COVID actually was the reason that I left. You know what I mean? It gave me the out. Like, it gave me the out. But I was ready to go. But the money was what was keeping me there. I mean, I was getting to work in tears. I would have to leave, go into the bathroom in the middle of happy hour and cry because I was so miserable. But I kept showing up every day because I was making really good money. So it just depends on how much you're willing to put up with, and how much you're willing to risk by doing a half-assed job, you know?
Right.
It's just to piggyback off of Dre's question, and to go into what I was trying to ask before, how do you and your husband decompress?
TMI, brother.
No, I'm not talking. No, pause.
I mean,
no,
first of all, we don't talk about work. That's the number.
Okay,
one. Right.
We do not talk about work.
That's what I want to know. Yeah,
I know what you meant. Yeah, we don't talk about work, unless it's just like a funny little anecdotal story or whatever, something cute or funny that happened. But yeah, I don't talk to him about my consumers anymore, because I used to vent to him, and then he would just be like, so what are we having for dinner? You know, because I'm tired here, and this, you know, and maybe you should quit this job. And I'm like, no. I like my job. I just had to, you know, so I just stopped talking about it. That's our number one thing.
Okay.
But it was so good talking to you guys. I really
I was gonna say, you sound like you're ready to become a preacher.
I might
you know. Or a lawyer.
Man, that's a lot of school. But I appreciate you guys having me on. I really do.
It was dope. It was a dope conversation.
Yeah, we got to do this again.
For sure. Yeah. You know, I got lots of opinions on a lot of stuff.
Right.
Yeah,
and
we'll find something
every time.
Right, for sure.
So that sound you heard, as you already know, for those who are listening, we want to say thank you for listening on our streaming platforms. But that sound that you heard means that it is time for the APB, and who I'm looking for, who I got my bulletin out for, even though I'm encouraged to hear what Rachel said about the status of actual field workers in social services, I'm looking for men, even though that may be her case there in DC. It's a field much like what you find in education, much like what you find in hospitals and healthcare. It's a field that's dominated by women. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times what you have is you have basically caseworkers that are women who have to show up to these places. And, you know, she mentioned that about how it's not the greatest paying job, although a lot of times there'll be really good benefits and things like that. But once there's another opportunity that comes along, people just kind of bounce out of there and they go somewhere else. I'm all for upward mobility and getting your money and everything. But I just want to encourage more men to be involved and get into actual the hands in the dirt social work, being involved, because as much as we talk about schools and how schools need more Black male teachers, they need more men who are actually working in those places. Social work is just the exact same way. It would go a long way to have more men who were involved because it's important for people to know that the people who are advocating for them, the people who they're actually going to, who's petitioning, who's on their side, it's important that they see that men actually care about making sure that you get the services that you need as well, as opposed to just being on the other end of it, where it's just like, I need something from me. It's not, and I'll just say this, you know, not to be too high and mighty about it, but, you know, it's very honorable. And I appreciate what people like Rachel do. My aunt, she's retired. I mentioned that. I really respect people.
We appreciate people. You too, Riff.
What's that?
We appreciate you too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But and here's the point. In ministry, a lot of my time is spent coordinating, working with people mm-hmm. who are actually dealing with social services. I'm not no mega preacher. I'm not out here flying around on private jets and doing, you know, big conferences. Stuff. I'm actually one of those guys. They know me in the hood in a lot of these places because I'm that person that tends to be that buffer. And again, representation always matters. And so it's important that men make sure that we are represented and making sure that we care about social services getting out to people. So that's my APB. I'm looking for men to show up, especially even like what Rachel said. You know, she didn't just get out of school and decide, oh, I'm going to go in. She worked other jobs and did a lot of things she didn't get into until she was in her 30s. The point being, it's not like you have to be young, fresh out of college. You can be a little bit older and look at it even as a career change and, you know, find out if that's for you, but at least be willing to look into that to make a difference.
Absolutely. And okay. Real quick off of that, because I don't think we actually said it, but thank you to the
absolutely
and people that because mm-hmm. Talk about a thankless job. Jesus.
Man.
Boy.
So
you never get good news. You never have a good day.
Your job is to get bad news.
And yeah. So I definitely want to, you know, send a shout out speak on behalf of the show, sending a shout out to social workers and people who deal with crisis management and all of that. Not just nurses and, you know, doctors and first responders and things like that. These people are on the front lines as well. And going into some super uncomfortable situations.
And if we gave more thank yous, like you're saying, Andre, we wouldn't have as difficult a time finding high quality people who were willing to go into that. And so I think the thank yous should
be on your check.
Well, but the check, I'm expecting, I'm going to get my check. However,
I'm just saying, that's how you thank me.
But the thank you.
How you thank me, bro.
You can thank me more than once. How about that?
Okay, in more than one way.
Okay. See, pause. Y'all all over the place with that. All over the place. Y'all went several ways with that one.
Wow. All right, that's a wrap. Once again, we want to thank you for joining us here at The Gray Matters. As always, we appreciate you for joining us. Continue to follow us on all of our streaming platforms.
Please.
Or join us by way of YouTube if you want to take a look at us, especially this one right here. Leave comments, questions, show topics, anything you want to ask us about, even. Anything, you can insult Paul, okay? He's got thick skin. But we're here for it, whatever it is. We just want to hear back from you.
So you please interact. Insult him anyway.
So with that, thank you once again. We hope to see you again next time as we bring you more fresh takes and conversations that you can't find anywhere else. So be safe out there. Be kind and be blessed.
Thank you, Rachel. Peace.
Thanks, Rachel. Peace.
So a preacher, a stay-at-home dad, and a rapper walk into a bar.
I am my ancestors back from the grave. No longer a slave, beat to the gods, meal, pray, survive in my day. A threat to society, cause Malcolm showed me the way. I'm young, black, intelligent.
Oh, now they're afraid.
It's too late, I am the king, I am the spark to the brain. I am the light that fought the dark and now you see in the rain. I am the thing they spent their whole life killing. To find out, I am the rose that grew from under their building. This ain't for life, this is the fight so you can open your mind. Peel the scab back, reveal the blood and see what we'll find.
Promise.
Like LeBron, I am just one of a kind. No longer will I accept the blind, leading the blind. Keep it a buck, say what I want, not giving a screaming after World I Park until the day my heart stops. And when I do, remember when I take my last breath. Just remind the tape and witness all the knowledge I left the grave. So I said, a preacher, a stay-at-home dad, and a rapper walk into a bar. The Gray Matters.